From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Three of the four sexual assault charges in Sweden against WikiLeaks whistleblower Julian Assange are being dropped due to the statute of limitations tolling, with one charge remaining in place while the statute runs for another 5 years. But Assange, who denies all the charges, says he isn't going anywhere just yet. RT's Anastasia Cherkina filed this report from outside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where Assange has taken refuge.
The pursuit of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange, who is still claiming refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy here in London, has now continued for so long that three out of four allegations against him are expiring. Sweden, which has unsuccessfully tried to question Assange about allegations of sexual assault made by two women in 2010, has a statute of limitation. If charges for certain offenses aren't brought within 5 years, they never will be. And as it stands, Assange has not officially been charged. The allegation of unlawful coercion and sexual molestation expire this Thursday. Then on Tuesday, a second case of sexual molestation will reach its time limit too. Assange has consistently denied all allegations made against him and believes if he gives himself up to Sweden, he will very soon after find himself extradited to the U.S. The allegation of rape will not expire for another 5 years, which means he still can't leave the embassy without being arrested in the U.K. and sent to Sweden. Rumor has it that this sushi place just around the corner from the small room Julian Assange calls home is his favorite. Unconfirmed media reports suggest the whistleblower spent £9,000 on takeaway in just 1 year. But that's nothing compared to what the British taxpayer has stumped up to keep an eye on the Ecuadorian embassy 24/7 for the last 3 years. It's cost a whopping £12 million and counting.
That's why there's always police there. No, that's ridiculous. That's crazy. I didn't know that.
Do you think UK officials could spend that money elsewhere?
Elsewhere, yeah, 100%. 100%, that's absolutely crazy.
To speed his never-ending case along, Assange offered to be questioned from behind these walls many times, but to no avail. The Swedes want him to come to them. But neither the UK or Sweden made any promises about not sending him to America. So Assange sees walking out in public as akin to walking into the lion's den. The US has been building an espionage case against him for years, following the release of highly sensitive diplomatic material and cables shedding more light on exactly what kind of foreign policy games the U.S. has been up to for years. Anastasia Cherkina, RT, London.
Cuba's Fidel Castro turned 89 on Thursday, and the former Cuban president said the only birthday present he'd like is for the U.S. to pay back what he said were the many millions of dollars owed to his country due to the 50-year-long U.S. embargo. Castro wrote the request in one of his regular Reflections column for the Cuban newspaper Granma. In it he wrote, quote, Cuba is owed the equivalent of damages amounting to many, many millions of dollars, as our country has reported and irrefutably documented at the United Nations, closed quote. The essay's publication and Fidel's 89th birthday come on the eve of the reopening of the U.S. Embassy in Havana, part of a restoration of diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is expected to arrive in Havana for the opening ceremony. Iran's foreign minister concluded a one-day visit to Syria as part of his tour of the region. During his stay in Damascus, Mohammad Javad Zarif met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and his Syrian counterpart, Walid al-Mualem, as Tehran pushes for a peace plan to end the ongoing crisis in Syria. Press TV's Mohammed Ali has more from the Syrian capital.
On Wednesday, Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif arrived in the Syrian capital Damascus following a brief trip to neighboring Lebanon. Upon his arrival at Damascus International Airport, the Iranian top diplomat was welcomed by Syrian Deputy Foreign Minister Faisal al-Maqdad. He then headed to the presidential palace where he met with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. During the meeting, the two discussed ways to peacefully settle the deadly crisis in Syria. Zarif said the Syrian people's will should be the base of any initiative without any foreign intervention. He also reaffirmed Iran's continuous support for the Syrian nation. Assad, in turn, welcomed Iran's efforts towards peaceful settlement of the conflict in Syria.
We had good discussions with the president about solving the Syrian unrest. Time has come for everyone to respect the will of the Syrian people in fighting terrorism.
The Iranian official also met with his Syrian counterpart, Walid al-Muallim, in which the terms of an Iranian initiative for resolving the unrest were discussed in detail. Experts have underlined the importance of Iran's firm stance on the peaceful settlement of the crisis in Syria.
We have three major regional powers: Iran, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. Iran is in the best position to be positive in this regard, because it has earned international respectability after the signing of the agreement regarding the nuclear program. And of course, we know that Saudi Arabia and Turkey are not in the best of the positions because they are involved in certain violent acts here and there.
Iran has been exerting efforts for bringing Syrian sides together in a bid to find a political settlement in the country. The Iranian official's visit comes within the framework of ongoing consultations between both countries in terms of finding a political exit for Syria's unrest, as Iran has been one of the main supporters of a peaceful solution for the Arab country in a manner that would keep its sovereignty and independence respected. Muhammad Ali, Press TV, Damascus.
Meanwhile, Russia's foreign minister Sergei Lavrov met in Moscow with his Saudi counterpart. Lavrov warned against the continued U.S.-Saudi effort to oust Syria's president by force, while the Saudi foreign minister, Adel Al-Jubeir, whose country is both backing anti-government forces in Syria and conducting an air war over Yemen, said his country was determined to remove Syria's government. At a press conference in Moscow, Lavrov stressed that it's ISIS, not Damascus, that's the threat to its neighbors and the world at large. RT's Katie Pilbeam was there and filed this report.
Some strong words from the Saudi party today, absolutely convinced that a coalition between Riyadh and Assad is out of the question. As far as they're concerned, Assad has no place in Syria's future.
The issue of Bashar Assad has been settled. He has no place in the future of Syria. The only question we're still concerned with is how exactly he will be removed. It will either happen peacefully through a transitional government, or it will happen through military means.
Now, this contrasts with what Russia's foreign minister believes. He says getting rid of Assad in a military means would actually empower ISIS, and actually that the coalition need to have another look at their enemies, and perhaps they have their priorities all wrong.
I certainly hope that none of the major powers which are somehow involved in the Syrian crisis are hoping to resolve the issue of President Assad through military means, because the only such means would be a takeover by Islamic State and other terrorists. I doubt that anyone wants that to happen. President Assad is not a threat to any neighboring country, while ISIL is not just publicly threatening Iraq, Syria and Saudi Arabia. These terrorists are drawing maps stretching from Spain to Pakistan.
Now, the foreign minister of Russia also pointed out that the bombings thus far, the coalition air bombings, have not resulted in destroying ISIS. If anything, they're still growing progressively. And he's saying that a joint coalition would be a better option. This would ignite the Iraqi forces, the Syrian forces, as well as Kurdish forces as well. But in order to achieve this, Assad would be crucial.
Although those U.S.-led bombing raids have not had any discernible impact on ISIS in Syria, there have been a number of casualties of the airstrikes among Syrian civilians, as Press TV's Kovi Tavwe reports.
At least 8 civilians, including 5 children, have been killed in the U.S.-led airstrikes on a weapons depot belonging to a militant group in Syria. The air raid happened in the northwest Idlib province. The so-called Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the airstrikes have also killed 10 members of Jaish al-Sunnah militant group allied with al-Nusra Front. U.S. airstrikes against ISIL and al-Qaeda franchise in Syria have killed large numbers of civilians. Similar attacks in neighboring Iraq have also left many civilians dead.
The continuing Saudi air war against Yemen has caused over 4,000 conflict-related deaths and over 19,800 injuries since it began on March 26th. At least 7 people, including 2 women and a child, were killed in the latest Saudi attacks on the Yemeni province of Sa'ada Wednesday. Local media outlets reported the Saudi war plans bombarded the district of Razi in Sa'ada, a northwestern province, killing 5 civilians and injuring at least 2 others. A child was also killed in a separate Saudi bombing blitz on the district of Kitafwa al-Bokeh in the same province. Saudi fighter jets also bombed Daher and conducted airstrikes in other Yemeni provinces, including Al-Jawf and Mahrib. The Saudis also targeted Sa'adah with dozens of rocket attacks. In one of those attacks, Saudi forces hit an area in the district of Hayden, killing 1 woman and injuring at least 4 other civilians. But Yemen's people are standing firm against the Saudi attacks, as Press TV's Mohammed Al-Attab reported from the capital, Sana'a.
Residents of Yemen's Bani al-Harith held a special ceremony in a Rawda area, which is located to the north of the capital Sana'a, to show support for fighters that are defending Yemen against the Saudi-led military aggression. Demonstrators chanted anti-US and anti-Saudi slogans, vowing to defend Yemen against relentless Saudi-led bombardments and ground attacks. They say they are ready to respond to the call of the Ansar Allah's leader for an all-out war in case Saudi Arabia decides to continue its unlawful war on Yemen.
We tell the whole world that the Yemenis have reached a point of no return. Because of the illegal Saudi war, we have congregated here in response to the Ansarullah leader, Sayyid Abdul Malik al-Houthi, to tell him that we are ready to wage an all-out war against Saudi Arabia.
Participants have expressed their anger toward relentless Saudi attempts to destroy the country's infrastructure and fan the flames of division.
Don't forget that Yemen has been the graveyard of invaders for many centuries. We tell Saudi Arabia's mercenaries that they will eventually be defeated in spite of the strong support they receive from the Saudi regime and the U.S.
The recent diplomatic efforts by Oman and Algeria to end the Saudi-led war on Yemen ended in total failure. Now participants in this ceremony say such efforts were merely meant to help implement U.S. agenda for the whole region through the gates of Aden. Scholars and dignitaries in their speeches at the ceremony have warned against the growing threat that Al-Qaeda and the ISIL terrorist group pose to the security of the region. They say the Yemenis should stand strongly against the threats of such terrorist groups, which they say have been created by the United States and Saudi Arabia.
Yemenis who have gathered here in a show of resilience in the face of the Saudi aggression, they say they are ready to make the ultimate sacrifice to defend their country against Saudi Arabia. Mohammed Al-Attab, Press TV, Sana'a.
In Syria and Ukraine, where another proxy war is being conducted, such aid as can be provided by the UN's World Food Program may be the only thing standing between the people living in those war zones and starvation. In Ukraine, cash vouchers from the program are being distributed to help people in the eastern part of the country, which is currently under siege by forces from Kiev, buy food. This week, program workers began distributing cash to 60,000 people, mostly internally displaced persons in the regions of Lugansk and Donetsk. Maria Carlino filed this report.
Since fighting broke out between pro-Russian rebels and government forces last year in eastern Ukraine, people have been suffering from food shortages and poor nutrition, according to WFP. John Carlos Stepone, WFP's representative in the country, said the food agency is using cash transfers in areas where banks and markets are functioning to restore normalcy to people's otherwise shattered lives. WFP partner Mercy Corp began distributing the first round of cash vouchers this week in northern Luhansk. Each person will receive the equivalent of $20.50 per month, most of which is likely to be spent on food. The agency has expanded its emergency operation in eastern Ukraine to provide food assistance to more than 575,000 people until the end of the year. Maria Carlino, United Nations.
Meanwhile, the head of the World Food Program, Etharin Cousin, made an appeal to the international community Thursday to not forget the victims of the fighting in Syria, which has displaced millions of people to neighboring countries. She issued the call after a 4-day visit to the region. The program had been supporting 1.5 million Syrian refugees in 5 countries, but has had to cut food assistance by nearly half due to funding shortfalls. Deanne Penn reports.
Ms. Cousin met with Syrian refugees and government officials in Jordan and Lebanon to draw attention to her agency's financial crisis. The World Food Program needs $163 million to continue supporting Syrians in these 2 countries, as well as in Egypt, Turkey, and Iraq, over the next few months. Ms. Cousins said WFP assistance provides stability to these displaced people.
Until they can go home and go back to school and go back to work, we must help provide the assistance that is required so that no child is lost and everyone has the ability to provide the food for their family that they need to continue to dream that tomorrow is going to be better than today.
The WFP chief called on countries to continue to help Syrian refugees. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Iran has been trying to fill the gaps in emergency relief that the international organizations have been unable or unwilling to fill. Peter Maurer, president of the International Committee of the Red Cross, thanked Iran for its humanitarian aid to the war-torn country. Maurer made the remarks in a meeting with the Secretary General of Iran's Red Crescent Society, Ali Asghar Ahmadi, in Tehran. The ICRC president said the Red Cross has intensified aid efforts in recent days, but that a lot more needs to be done to meet the demands in Yemen. He termed the situation in the country catastrophic. On Tuesday night, a symposium was held at the Solidarity Center in New York City, which focused on the connection between the U.S. wars abroad and the economic crisis at home. One of those presenting was Joe Lombardo, who chairs the United National Anti-War Coalition, or UNAC. He spoke about the ongoing wars involving the U.S. and its allies, and focused in particular on the war in Syria.
It's a time when there is an escalation of the hostilities orchestrated by the United States and imperialists in Syria, and also a time that there's this peace plan supposedly going on in with Iran, which I support because the Iranians support it, but I have no I understand that the United States has no right to impose on Iran what they are imposing. Sure, the U.S. has more nuclear weapons than anybody else, but the U.S. also knows very, very clearly that Iran has no nuclear weapons program. And yet they're going into these negotiations and they want to do inspections. Well, we shouldn't forget what inspections meant in Iraq. Inspections meant in Iraq that U.S. forces and others went there. They also knew there was no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, but they went there and they figured out the targets for the U.S. when the U.S. invaded Iraq. And it's a violation of the self-determination of the people of Iran to insist that these outside powers can go into that country and investigate whether they have nuclear weapons or not, when they all know they don't, and they don't have any such program. So it is a violation of their right to self-determination, but the Iranian people, the Iranian government want it, and I support it, and the reason they want it is because they need relief from these sanctions. Now, I've gotten two calls, and I don't watch TV very much, but when I turned on the TV, I've seen these ads against the Iran agreement. I couldn't believe it. I've never remember seeing stuff like that so clear. And the two calls I got, the first one, both of them were by women asking me to lobby Gillibrand, who's the state senator in New York, to not support the deal. So the first woman I tried to talk to, and I said, well, you know, she knew nothing. She was paid by someone to read a script and ask me to do certain things. She knew nothing. She was not someone on the side of there. The second person I just yelled at, you know, so. But so there is a concern because it's clear there's a difference in the rulers in this country on what to do there. But I do believe it's gonna pass because you have to think further than it. Suppose it fails. Suppose the agreement fails. How will the rest of the world react? You know, I've listened to commentary from other countries, U.S. supported countries like the BBC and so forth. They think this is Obama's greatest achievement. They are all for it. Other countries do not want to keep up these sanctions, want to have some kind of trade agreement with Iran. Will it cause splits in their own groupings of imperialist powers over this thing? Will it drive Iran more towards powers that the United States does not want it to be driven towards, like Russia and China and so forth? So I think that they're going to make a big fuss over it, and then they're going to pass it. But I don't really know. But the interesting thing is, while they are doing this diplomatic thing in Iran, they are escalating the war in Syria. And I worry again, because the United States did not negotiate a deal with Iran about nuclear weapons, because they know Iran does not have a nuclear program. So what did they negotiate? What are they talking about? What did they do? Are they trying to pressure Iran, perhaps, to not give the same kind of support to Syria? Is that a possibility? Part of the escalation against Syria recently, and I don't know that everybody agrees with me on this, is this new UN thing that we heard, where the UN will be able to go into Syria and investigate chemical weapons. Now, remember the false flag incident where they said Syria did these chemical weapons? Then they took all of Syria's chemical weapons, and Syria said, okay, we don't intend to use them anyway, take them. They took them all. So now they're trying to say, well, maybe Syria's done it again, used chemical weapons on its own people. And Syria says, what are you talking about? We gave them all to you. Well, maybe you hid some, you know, there's always this kind of thing. So what is this commission about if they've already given up their chemical weapons when they say they're going to? And it also worries me that Russia bought onto this, which has been an ally of Syria. That was one piece of the escalation. The other piece, as we know, people mentioned that a couple of years ago, Obama decided he was going to bomb Syria, and in a serious way. He was going to take out the infrastructure and so forth. It wasn't going to be just a symbolic bombing, like Israel did a couple of times. It was more than symbolic, but it wasn't a massive, continuous bombing. He decided he was going to do that through ships off the coast and other things like that. And there was such an outcry all around the world and in this country, and he had to get on TV and back down. What a historic moment that is, that the President of the United States, the President of World Imperialism, backed down on TV in front of everybody. It must have been a humiliating defeat. But look, he's now bombing Syria. So he figured out a way to do it. And we need to figure out a way to let people understand that everything you didn't want him to do, he is now doing. And he got bases for the planes from Turkey to be able to take off in Turkey. The only reason that didn't happen before was because the Turkish people didn't want it. Not the Turkish government didn't want it. Turkish people didn't want it. And it would have been difficult. But they gave them the right to take off planes from two bases within Turkey to continue to bomb. And they got Turkey to bomb. But what did Turkey do? Turkey did what their real agenda is. It did not bomb ISIS. It did not bomb the al-Nusra Front. It bombed the Kurds. You know, and who are the Kurds? They're the people who have done the most fighting and the most successful fighting, except for, of course, the army of Syria against these terrorists that are there, which are allies of the U.S. and were made by the U.S. and are supported and armed and funded by U.S. and U.S. allies. The whole sectarianism that goes into this was started by the United States. When we went into Iraq, there was no sectarianism that went on there. There was no Al-Qaeda. There was a small group, they called it Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was in one small part of the Kurdish area. There was no big Al-Qaeda or any of these fundamentalists that were fighting in there. How did it happen? It happened through instigating sectarianism. The U.S. insisted that everybody carry a card, an identification card in Iraq. That identification card had to say whether you were Sunni or Shia or Christian or Kurd or Arab. It divided people by these lines. And then they had quotas. Who can get how many jobs by, the quotas were by what sect you were from. A lot of people didn't know what sect they were from. They were just there, you know? But they enforced this kind of quota system. They built walls between the communities and forced the Shias and the Sunnis to separate. And they created this kind of sectarianism which was going to build the kind of Al-Qaeda structures and the kind of structures that we see now and the kind of sectarianism. Syria has never been a sectarian country. The Christians and the Sunnis and the Shias and anybody else could live there and be themselves. And that goes in the face of this whole policy of the United States of sectarianism and divide and conquer. That just that model had to be gotten rid of, if nothing else. And they're trying to get rid of it. But, you know, you look at ISIS, you look at the al-Nusra Front, you look at the United States, and they're all doing the same thing. They're looking for regime change in Syria. That's why I say they are the allies that are going on there. So there is an escalation going on at the same time that there is this negotiation going on in Iran. And so many liberals in this country now are so tied into this fight that, you know, we gotta lobby Schumer because he just came out on the wrong side of this deal. We gotta protest at this office. We gotta do this, we gotta do that. So much of the focus is there. At the same time, there's this escalation going on in Syria. It's something we have to be very conscious of and very serious about. And so this is a wonderful meeting because in the midst of that, while others that consider themselves anti-war activists are not doing this, we are here opposing U.S. and imperialist aggression in Syria, exactly the thing that we should be doing. And what we need to do is do this meeting and street demonstrations and counter the propaganda that's coming out of the capitalist media all throughout the country. So those that are listening, those that are here, those that are on UNEX lists, those that are anti-war activists, this is the model of what we have to do. We have to do it throughout the country. We have to build a strong force that can stay the U.S. hand. If Syria falls, if Syria goes the way that Libya went, it will be a disaster. It will be a disaster in terms of the fight against real terrorists. It will be a disaster in terms of the entire region. Look what happened when Libya fell. The stability of the entire region collapsed. When you see all these refugees coming across the Mediterranean trying to get out of that area, it's because of what we did in that goddamn area. And we have to end it. We can't allow that to happen anymore. We, in the belly of the beast, must fight U.S. imperialism with everything we have.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.